A fresh Dolaran broadside came howling in. This one was better aimed, and Harris Iwane watched a round shot carve its way through the midship's bulwark. Splinters of shattered planking, some of them 3 feet long or more, went hissing across the deck, and tatters of shredded canvas flapped wildly as the shot tore through the tightly rolled hammocks standing on end and netted between the stanchions atop the bulwark. Two men went down on the number 5 carronade. One of them hit the sanded deck limply in a splattered spiderweb of blood, but the other screamed, clutching at the jagged splinter standing out of his right shoulder. Someone dragged the wounded man clear, and two men from the starboard battery, one each from number 6 and number 8 carronades, moved quickly to replace the casualties. The captain absorbed all those details, as well as the fresh holes appearing in his fore topsail and a length of shrouds blowing sideways in the wind as it was clipped off by yet another round shot. But he absorbed them with only a corner of his brain. The rest of his attention was focused on the third ship in the Dolaran line. She was almost directly opposite shield now, and no more than 50 yards away. He waited a moment longer, and then his sword slashed downward.
Fire!
Shield fired on the downroll. In point of fact, Captain Iwane's range estimate had been slightly off. The actual distance from Grand Vicar Morris was only 40 yards, and the avalanche of Shield's fire crashed into Rosale's ship with devastating effectiveness. Despite the fact that Grand Vicar Morris had been designed and built as a warship, her frames and timbers weren't as heavy as Shield's, and the Carisian ship's guns were heavier. 30-pound round shots sledgehammered through them with contemptuous ease, slamming across the Dolaran's gun deck in butchering fans of splinters. Iwane's gunners were far more experienced than Rosale's. They could see their target more clearly, and they were better judges of their own ship's motion as well, and they timed Shield's roll almost perfectly. Despite the short range, despite their experience, a great many of their shots managed to miss anyway. Only someone who'd actually fired a smoothbore cannon in the midst of the smoke and thunder and howling chaos of a naval battle could truly realize just how difficult it actually was to hit something the size of an enemy warship under those circumstances, even at relatively short range. But far fewer of Shield's gun crews missed their target, and none of their fire went high. Every hit smashed into their target's hull, and they were close enough to hear the screams. Captain Raisando grimaced as the second Carisian ship came into action. There was no mistaking the sound of that single, massive broadside, or, for that matter, the sudden eruption of fresh smoke. He peered aft, trying to decide which ship the Carisian had targeted. It was hard to make out details. In fact, he could barely see HMS Bedard's headsails as she sailed along in Rockerai's wake. It didn't look as if Ondair Krall's ship had been hit, though, and Raisando was unpleasantly confident that a Carisian broadside fired at such short range wasn't going to completely miss its target. Must have been Grand Vicar Morris, he decided. The thought evoked mixed emotions. Personally, Raisando hated Sir Darrand Rosale right down to his oh-so-nobly-born toenails. The man was an arrogant, aristocratic prig who'd never bothered to hide the fact that he was a member in good standing of the officers sucking up around the Duke of Thorast. Or, for that matter, to hide his disagreement with Earl Thirsk's notions of shipboard discipline. On the other hand, he'd complied with Thirsk's restrictions on the use of the lash, whether he agreed with them or not, and he had guts. He'd actually been willing to learn at least the rudiments of seamanship, however much he'd hated, taking lessons from commoners, for that matter, and no man who lived could question his willingness to come to grips with the enemy. I may hate the bastard, but the bloody-minded son of a bitch is in the right place right now. Rosale staggered as a section of rail 5 feet to his left disintegrated. Something slammed into his shoulder with brutal force, nearly knocking him to his knees, and he heard shrieks from the waist of the ship, where the bulk of the broadside had gone home. His right hand clutched convulsively at the undamaged rail in front of him, keeping him on his feet somehow, and he turned forward. His left shoulder felt broken, his arm dangling uselessly at his side, but there was no sign of blood, and a corner of his brain wondered what had hit him. There was no time to worry about that, however, and he stumbled forward to lean on the poop deck rail, staring toward the bow. Most of the enemy's fire had gone in low, punching into Grand Vicar Morris's gun deck. From the screams, it must have inflicted Shan Wei's own lot of casualties, he thought, then reminded himself not to assume the worst. A wounded man's shrieks could be loud enough for two or three, after all. But at least some of those round shot had plowed across the upper deck. Unlike Carizian ships, Grand Vicar Morris mounted no guns on her forecastle, but she did mount 10 on the upper deck in the waist, 5 in either broadside. Now there were only 2 in action to starboard. Rosale's jaw tightened. One of the 3 silenced 12-pounders was permanently disabled, dismounted by a direct hit. The other 2 appeared to be intact, but most of the 16 men who'd manned them were down, either dead or wounded. Of the 48 men who'd crewed all 3 pieces, no more than a dozen were on their feet, and they were all busy dragging dead and wounded crewmates away from the pair of still serviceable guns. Grand Vicar Morris was barely 160 feet long, yet billowing smoke, most of it rolling down from the enemy's guns now, made it difficult to pick out details forward of the waist. From what he could see, though, at least another half dozen or so seamen and soldiers serving as shipboard infantry were down as well. And that was only the upper deck. There was no telling how many men had been killed or wounded on the gun deck. Yet, despite the screams and the blood, Rosale's other gunners were still in action. They were firing independently now, as quickly as each crew could reload, without the disciplined unanimity of controlled broadsides. The cannon's thunder was a hellish cacophony, an almost uninterrupted succession of bellowing discharges. Accuracy had to be suffering as each gun captain fired blindly into the smoke at whatever he thought was the appropriate point in the ship's roll, but they were firing, and even through the bedlam, he heard shouts of encouragement from officers and petty officers, and of defiance from sailors and soldiers. He looked up. There were holes in several sails. Severed sheets and halyards blew on the wind here and there, and at least 4 or 5 dead men sprawled over the end of the main top, where they'd been marked down by the spitefully cracking rifles of Carizian Marines. Nothing critical seemed to have carried away, though, and even as he watched, topmen were swarming through the rigging, heedless of round shot and bullets alike, to repair the ship's running rigging. They'd never be anything but common-born scum, Rosale thought, all too many of them the sweepings of Garath's gutters. Yet, as he watched them, dragging dead and wounded messmates towards the center of the deck, making repairs in the teeth of the Carizian fire, tossing broken bits of railing and fallen blocks off the breeches of their guns, reloading and firing again and again, he felt a fierce stab of pride in them.
"Lay it to them, lads!" he heard himself shouting. "Lay it to them!"
Captain Stewart swore under his breath, restraining a most uncaptainly temptation to pound a fist on the binnacle as the fury of the artillery exchange mounted. From his own position, astern and still up to windward, he could see darts and shields' masts clearly as their course folded together with the Dolorans. They were in action with 3 of the 5 Doloran galleons now, and the 4th enemy ship was about to pile in. So far, all of darts and shields' rigging seemed intact. Both ships were still under control, and, unlike the Dolorans, still firing controlled broadsides. That told Stuart a great deal. Despite the fury of the engagement, despite the fact that they were about to find themselves fighting at 2-to-1 odds, both Powell and Iwane were still firing broadsides, rather than go to independent fire. He suspected each of them was also engaging only a single enemy ship as well, preferring to methodically smash one target at a time rather than split their fire between two targets and inflict lighter damage on both. That took cool nerves, since it meant at least one of their opponents was left undisturbed, her gunners free to load and fire without worrying about round shot or grape shot screaming into their own faces. By the same token, it gave them a far better chance of completely disabling one of their foes relatively quickly. He turned his own attention to the last galleon in the Dolorin line. She seemed to be smaller than the others, little larger than his own undersized squall. Despite that, though, her captain was crowding on more sail as Stuart watched, resetting his courses to get more speed. Obviously, he intended to pile onto dart and shield as quickly as possible.
More gutsy and determined than smart, Stuart thought. Dart and shield are both faster than any of them are. He may be able to overtake with his courses set, but he's only going to cramp their own formation once he gets there. He certainly won't be able to get up to windward of Jean and Harris, whatever he does. In fact, he'll have to haul out of line and run into one of his own consorts.
It was a mistake, although, as mistakes went, it was preferable to a lot of others. At least that other captain was determined to get into action rather than hold back to avoid it. And that said unpleasant things about the degree to which the Royal Dolorin Navy's morale must have recovered since Rock Point and Crag Reach.
"Well, we'll just have to see what we can do about that, won't we, Arnald?" he thought grimly.
Captain Rysando was in no position to see what Captain Martin Germain's Prince of Dolar was doing. The dense smoke made that impossible from deck level, and the men aloft, including those detailed as lookouts, were, understandably, more focused on the Carizian ships alongside than on their own consorts. If Rysando had been able to watch Prince of Dolar's maneuvers, however, he would have fully endorsed Arnald Stewart's analysis of Germain's actions. At the same time, little though he would have liked what Germain was doing, he would also have agreed with Stuart that too much aggressiveness was a far better problem to have than too much timidity. Just at the moment, however, Rysando had rather more pressing things to worry about. The leading Carizian galleon was slowly closing the range, despite Rysando's own turn away, and her fire was both unpleasantly heavy and dismayingly accurate. The steady, measured bellow of her guns, obviously still firing in controlled broadsides, was like the rhythmic concussion of some giant spiked boots tramping relentlessly across rockerized decks. He was confident he was scoring more hits of his own now that the range had dropped, but Carizian round shot were beating in rockerized bulwarks and side like the remorseless blows of that same giant's club. A half dozen of rockerized guns, a quarter of her entire larboard battery, were out of action now, and the pile of bodies along the center line of the deck was growing thicker. Wounded men were being dragged below to the healers and surgeons, making it hard to form any detailed estimate, but Rysando suspected that he'd taken at least 40 or 50 casualties. That was almost 1 in 8 of his entire company, yet the crew, experienced seamen and pressed landsmen alike, stood steadily to their guns, firing back as quickly as they could reload. The Carizian continued to fire low, smashing broadside after broadside into Rockerai's hull, slaughtering her crewmen steadily, while the marksmen in darts tops fired across at their Dolorin counterparts or down into the smoke below. At least a few Carizian shot had gone high, though, and Rockerai's deck was littered with fallen blocks and lengths of cordage. Raisando had seen two or three men felled by those heavy plunging blocks, and he castigated himself for not having thought of the protective rope nets he'd observed aboard the Carizian galleons before fire was opened. Obviously, they'd been rigged above the enemy's decks to catch debris and bodies falling from overhead, and he made a mental note to suggest that Dolar adopt the same practice in his report to Earl Thirsk. Of course, first he had to get back to make that report. Jean Powell's head jerked up as something cracked thunderously overhead. For a moment, he didn't know what it had been, but then his eyes widened as he saw the entire main topmast beginning to topple. "Oh, shit," he heard a mental voice say almost calmly, and then he was dodging as the wreckage began to plummet.
"Yes!"
Captain Andare Krall of HMS Bedard realized the voice shouting that single word was his own. It probably wasn't a properly heroic thing for the captain of a king ship to be doing, but at the moment he didn't much care. His gun crews had been pounding away at the lead Carizian for what seemed like hours, whatever his lying pocket watch said, without any apparent effect. He hadn't even been able to convince the bastard to divert any of his fire to Bedard. Instead, the enemy had continued to hammer mercilessly at Rockerai. Krall couldn't see the flagship clearly, but he could see Raisando's sails becoming more and more tattered, and, difficult as it was to form any accurate judgment in such a bedlam, it sounded to him as if Rockerai's fire had begun to drop. Now he watched his target's main topmast, topgallant, and royal pitch slowly to larboard, like some falling forest giant. The mizzen royal went with it, and for a moment he hoped the foremast might go as well. He was disappointed in that, but the Carizian galleon seemed to stagger, as over half her set canvas went thundering over the side.
"Now what, you bastards?" he thought.
Dart slowed precipitously with the abrupt loss of power. Captain Powell was astounded that the fore royal and topgallant didn't go as well, but he felt the sudden drag of the wreckage landing in the water alongside, still tethered to the ship by shrouds and stays only too clearly. The overhead nettings, still more or less intact, although they'd snapped like cobwebs where the butt of the main topmast had fallen across the larboard bulwark, were littered with broken wood, fallen blocks, and long snakes of cordage. Somehow, the men on the wheel managed to maintain control, and axes and even cutlasses were flashing amid the tangled snake chaos of fallen rigging as the bosun and his mates led parties of seamen to cut away the wreckage. Until they could, though, almost half of Dart's larboard guns were blocked by the debris lying across their ports. That was bad enough, but their lost speed meant the Dolorans would begin drawing ahead. They were going to be able to bring all five of their ships into action against the head of Powell's own line. He'd lost his speaking trumpet in the scramble to avoid the plummeting wreckage, so he cupped his hands around his mouth in an improvised substitute.
"Master Dykar!"
Dart's first lieutenant managed to hear him despite the tumult, and Powell pointed urgently at the suddenly stubby-looking mainmast.
"Get the course on her!" he shouted.
Dykar looked at him for a moment, then nodded in obvious understanding. The course wasn't part of the ship's normal fighting sail. It was too big, too cumbersome, and too close to the upper deck when it was set. The loss of the main topsail and topgallant sail had to be compensated for somehow, though, and the first lieutenant started dragging men out of the damage control parties and off of the disengaged guns and starting them aloft. Powell left him to it, turning his own attention back to the enemy, and his jaw tightened as he saw the Dolorin sails beginning to move ahead, exactly as he'd feared. Harris I. Wayne swore vigorously as Dart slowed. He had no choice but to reduce sail himself if he was going to keep station on the flagship. Part of him wanted to overtake Dart instead and get around in front of her. But if he did, his own guns would be masked by Dart's hull as he passed along her disengaged side, preventing him from firing a shot until he'd cleared Powell's ship. His mind worked feverishly, considering alternatives. At the moment, he didn't know whether or not the Dolorans meant to push the engagement fully home. If they wanted to break off, satisfied they'd protected their convoy, the damage to Dart's rigging offered them the perfect opportunity to do just that. If, on the other hand, they wanted to stay and fight it out, that same damage would give them a pronounced maneuvering advantage. There was no doubt in Iwane's mind what a Carizian squadron would do, but Dolorans weren't Carizians. They might decide to content themselves with the knowledge that they'd already done far better against Dolaran war galleons than anyone else had managed, and the convoy, currently under attack by Flash and Mace, was their primary responsibility. "Best stay where we are and pound their trailers as hard as we can," he decided. But he also beckoned one of his midshipmen to his side. "Get forward, Master Walker," he told the white-faced 12-year-old flatly. "I want you at the 4 top gallant crosstrees. You watch the flagship. Don't take your eyes off her. If she alters course, or you see one of these bastards working around ahead of her, you get your ass back down here and tell me. Got it?"
"Aye, aye, sir," the youngster replied, and went scampering off through the smoke and the thunder.
Ondaire Krall's ship crept steadily further forward. Ondaire Krall's ship crept steadily further forward, running broadside to broadside with the bigger, more powerful, but lamed Carizian galleon. Round shot hammered back and forth, and despite her damage aloft and the growing number of shot holes, Krall could see in her bulwarks and side, the Carizian was still giving as good as she got. And her guns were still heavier than anything he had, a point driven home as a Carizian round shot crashed through Bedard's side, killing a dozen men and shattering the carriage of one of her gun deck 25-pounders. He looked aft to where Grand Vicar Morris was finally beginning to draw clear of her duel with the second Carizian. Krall was no fonder of Sir Darren Rosale than Rosale was of him. Despite that, he had to admit the arrogant, aristocratic prick was no slouch. Grand Vicar Morris had taken a severe hammering from her opponent's more powerful artillery. Krall wasn't positive, but he thought he could actually see blood trickling from the scuppers of Rosale's ship. Despite that, her guns were still in action, and as he watched, they switched targets and began pounding the leading Carizian along with Bedard, while Mardai Saigon's guardsmen took up the second Carizian's challenge. Arnald Stewart made himself stand motionless, hands clasped behind him, face expressionless, as the Dolorans crowded in on shield and dart. The smoke was so dense now that he could see only the upper masts of the enemy galleons, but it was obvious what was happening. With dart slowed and shield trapped behind her, the lead Dolaran galleon was forging steadily ahead of the two Carizian ships. It wouldn't be long before she was in a position to swing further to the west, trying to head the Dolaran line, possibly even get into a position to rake dart from ahead.
"And I'm still not in a position to engage."
He glared up at his own sails, then made his decision.
"Shake out the topsail reefs, Master Maldin," he said crisply. "And after that, we'll have the Royal's honor, if you please."
"Oh, you bastard," Jean Powell thought grimly. Dart's deck was heaped with dead and wounded.
The wreckage of masts, sails, and spars had been cleared away, and the ship was under complete command once more. But even with the main course set, she was losing ground to her opponents. The lead Dolaran was two ships' lengths ahead of her, and the second ship in the Dolaran line was starting to range ahead as well. The third galleon had moved up to batter away at her, although that ship seemed to have been pretty well battered herself. Astern, he could hear Shield still in furious action, with the fourth ship in the Dolaran line now, and Powell's eyes were set and hard as he watched the angle of the first Dolaran's masts begin to shift. She was making her move to cut across Dart's course, and he turned to his own helmsman.
"Bring her 2 points to starboard," he ordered.
"Sir! Sir!"
Harris Iwane turned towards the high-pitched voice. Midshipman Walker ran towards him, barely even hesitating as a seaman staggered back. Both of the wounded man's hands flew up to clutch at the blood-splashed ruin where his face had been, and he fell to the deck directly in front of Walker. The boy simply hurtled over the body and slid to a stop, gasping for breath.
"What?" Iwane demanded.
"Sir," Walker panted, "Dart's altering to starboard, about 2 points, I think. And I couldn't see for sure, but I think it's because the enemy's trying to get round in front of her."
"Good lad."
Iwane slapped the boy on the back, then wheeled to his helmsman.
3 points to starboard," he snapped, then raised his speaking trumpet. "Hands aloft! Shake out the reefs and prepare to loose courses!"
Dart swung to starboard, altering course to take the wind on her starboard beam, as Rockerai tried to get around in front of her. Dart was turning inside the smaller ship, giving her a shorter distance to travel, but Rockerai was considerably faster now, and the duel between them redoubled in ferocity. Bedard, keeping station on Rockerai, continued to fire furiously, pounding away at Dart's quarter, and Powell was devoutly grateful that the Dolaran's accuracy matched neither their discipline nor their determination. Despite that, his ship was badly hit, and he knew it. He'd lost 5 guns out of his larboard broadside, and his starboard gun crews had been badly thinned by the need to replace killed and wounded in the other battery. He'd never had enough gunners to completely man both broadsides simultaneously. At this rate, he wouldn't have anybody at all on the starboard guns entirely too quickly. Someone cheered suddenly, and he wheeled back around just in time to see Grand Vicar Morris's mizzenmast pitch over the side. The Dolaran galleon slowed abruptly, and it was obvious the wreckage was hampering her steering. As Powell watched, her main top gallant followed the mizzen, and the battered Dolaran fell off before the wind, drifting down to leeward. Something loomed in the corner of his vision, and he looked to starboard just as Shield came foraging up on his disengaged side, leaning hard to the wind with the reefs shaken out of her topsails and her courses set below them. Her lee gun ports were barely 2 feet above the wave tops as she heeled heavily, and he knew instantly what Iwane had in mind. He snatched off his hat, waving it at the other ship.
"Look at that, boys!" he shouted. "Shield's going to bloody those bastards' nose for them!"
At least some of his men heard him, and he heard them raise a cheer in reply. It wasn't much of a cheer, not with so many of them already down, but it was far from defeated, and he bared his teeth in a fierce grin.
"Of course there's still the 2 bastards Iwane was fighting before," he thought harshly. "I'm sure they'll be along us soon enough, but let the lads cheer for now."
Even with her increased sail, Shield had needed a good 15 minutes to overtake and pass Dart. She'd been out of action that entire time, and Harris Iwane had felt the dull ache of his clenched jaw muscles as he heard the renewed thunder of artillery from behind him. He knew the 4th and 5th Dolaran galleons were crowding in on Dart, battering away at the badly wounded flagship with fresh fury, yet there was nothing he could do about that. Powell was just going to have to hang on while Shield dealt with Rockerai and Bedard. At least the respite had given time for him to reorganize his gun crews
reload carefully, and carry out some of the most essential rigging repairs while Shield forged ahead, leaning to the pressure on her canvas. He felt himself urging her along as she crept steadily ahead of Dart, and his brain clicked like one of the newfangled abacuses calculating ranges and bearings.
"Brail up the courses!" he shouted as the abacus in his head came together with a glimpse of the lead Dolaran's mastheads above the thinning smoke. Hands dashed to sheets and tacks and clue lines, and the sails began rising like huge curtains, drawn by invisible hands. The smoke was even thinner now. Shield was well ahead of Dart and still traveling considerably faster. And there!
"On the uproll!"
he barked, then paused a moment and...
"Fire as you bear!"
Caetano Raisando stood drumming the fingers of his right hand on the binnacle and squinting against the omnipresent choking smoke as Rockerai crept slowly but steadily ahead. Another 10 minutes, 15 at the outside, and he'd be far enough ahead to come still farther up to windward. With the Carizian's rigging damage, Rockerai was certain to be able to get closer to the wind. With just a very little luck, he was going to cross Dart's bows and... Another ship's bowsprit and headsails pushed suddenly clear of the smoke, and Raisando's squinted eyes flew wide. It was the second Dolaran galleon, and she'd set her courses without his noticing through the smoke and the confusion. "And through my concentration on their lead ship," he admitted, and cursed himself for letting it happen. He shouldn't have permitted his attention to narrow, but it was too late for that now. The Dolaran captain was running a risk carrying that much canvas in the middle of a battle. The wind pressure on the additional sail area increased the strain on his rigging badly. Even a normally minor hit aloft could produce serious damage to masts or spars under those conditions, and too much heel could drive his opened gun ports under, flooding his ship. But he'd accomplished what he wanted. His untouched courses, already disappearing as he cleared the obstacle of his flagship, looked impossibly white and pure against the dirty gray walls of smoke and the torn and stained canvas above them. Raisando didn't have long to contemplate their beauty, however. Even as he began to bark orders of his own, fire flashed in Shield's gun ports. The range was just under 200 yards. That was long range for a naval engagement, but Shield had been given time to get ready for it, and for the first time, she was firing on the uproll, not the downroll. The carefully aimed and prepared broadside scorched across the water between her and Rockerai, and the Dolaran ship's foremast disintegrated.
"Damn it!"
Raisando swore viciously as his foremast went over the side. His main topgallant mast went with it, and Rockerai wallowed at the sudden loss of sail area. The abrupt disappearance of the headsails made bad infinitely worse. Their most important function was to counterbalance her rudder and mizzen during maneuvers. With them gone, she fell off even more quickly than Grand Vicar Maris had. Shield altered course as well, preparing to swoop down on Rockerai and finish her off. But Bedard charged forward to intercept her as Captain Krall interposed his ship between her and his own damaged flagship. Jean Powell staggered, all but knocked off his feet, as one of his quarterdeck marines slammed into him. For a moment, he thought the corporal had been hit, but only for a moment. Just long enough for the marine to shove him out of the way of the toppling mizzen. The falling mast crushed at least three other members of Dart's crew, and the galleon staggered almost as badly as her captain had. Like the upper sections of the mainmast before it, the mizzen plunged over the side, dragging at the crippled ship, and once more, axes and cutlasses flashed amid the wreckage. Powell took one heartbeat to slap the marine on the shoulder in acknowledgement and thanks,
then turned back to the battle as HMS Guardsman and HMS Prince of Dolar charged up to complete Dart's destruction. Captain Martin Germain couldn't see what was happening ahead of the Dolaran flagship. In fact, he couldn't see much of anything through the choking smother of gunsmoke. It was everywhere, blinding, watering eyes, tearing at noses and lungs. Despite frequent gunnery practices, he truly hadn't realized until this moment just how thick and totally obscuring the smoke from so many cannon was going to be. But he could still make out the ghost-like, foggy shape of the target he'd been closing in upon for so long.
"Fire!"
he shouted, and Prince of Dolar's first broadside ripped into Dart. An entire section of Dart's midships bulwark disintegrated. Two of her carronades were dismounted, and another 23 of her crew were killed or wounded. Captain Powell staggered into the carnage, shouting orders through a throat that felt ripped raw, lending his own hands to clear away the wreckage.
"She can't take a lot more," he thought. "She just can't."
"Stand to your guns, boys," he heard himself shouting. "Hammer the bastards!"
The enemy's fire was finally beginning to falter, Mardai Saigon thought, and about damn time, too. Now that his own guardsman and Prince of Dolar had gotten to grips with her, the Carizian galleon had been engaged against all five members of Captain Raisando's squadron, and she'd given as good as she'd gotten to all of them.
"They may be frigging heretics,"
Saigon thought harshly,
"but they've got Chihira's own guts. Not that it's going to do them much good very much longer." "Pound her!"
he shouted.
"Pound the bitch!"
Germain watched Dart's mizzen crumple, and, like Saigon, he realized it was only a matter of time now. He still didn't know what was going on at the head of the line, but with three Dolaran galleons against a single Carizian, he wasn't too concerned about that. No, that was up to Raisando, Krall, and Rosail. He and Saigon had their own kraken to land, and...
"Fire as you bear!"
It had taken far too long, but Arnald Stewart felt his lips draw back in a hunting dragon's grin. The smoke and the Dolaran's concentration on dart and shield had concealed Squall's approach. He hadn't been able to see the enemy much better than they could have seen him, assuming they'd been looking, but he'd steered by what he could see of their mastheads. Now, leaning dangerously to the wind with all sail set to the royals, Squall came charging out of the smoke, erupting almost directly across Prince of Dolar's stern at a range of barely 30 yards. Gunport by gunport, all down her starboard side, double-shotted new-model krakens and 30-pounder carronades bellowed. There were 18 guns in that broadside. They hurled 36 carefully aimed iron balls, each 6 inches in diameter, down the full length of Prince of Dolar's decks. The Dolaran galleon's stern windows disintegrated, and round shots screamed the full length of her gun deck, killing gunners, dismounting weapons. Martin Germain never had time to realize what had happened before one of those round shot tore him in half. Another dismounted three of Prince of Dolar's quarterdeck guns. That single broadside killed or wounded a third of the galleon's entire crew, and, even worse, one shot smashed into her tiller head, and her wheel spun loosely as her rudder flapped freely. With no way to steer, she fell off, pivoting to point her bow straight downwind.
"Hard a larboard," Stewart snapped, "in royals and courses."
Acknowledgements came back, and the wheel spun to the left as the topman, poised aloft, started fisting in the canvas. Squall's rudder kicked to the right, and the ship turned sharp to starboard. Her speed had carried her past Prince of Dolar, and her new heading brought her swinging back around onto a southwesterly heading.
Hands to sheets and braces. Back the main topsail.
With so many men tending to her sails, Squall had only enough men to man a single broadside, but she slowed abruptly as the main topsail was thrown aback. It reduced her speed even more quickly, steadying her up just as Prince of Dolar fell completely off the wind and pointed her bow into Squall's starboard broadside.
Fire!
Another broadside ripped into the staggering Dolaran. There was no way for Stuart to know how devastating his two broadsides had been. Prince of Dolar was obviously badly hurt, yet there was no time to finish her off. Guardsman was still furiously engaged against Dart. Stuart couldn't even tell if the Dolaran galleon realized what had just happened to her consort, and Dart's fire was beginning to falter.
"Larboard your helm!" he commanded once more, and Squall came sweeping still further around, taking the wind on her starboard bow. "Brace round the main topsail, Master Maldin! Hands to the larboard battery there!"
Mardai Saigon wheeled around in shock at the sudden eruption of cannon fire astern of him. For just a moment, his mind was completely blank, unable to grasp what it could be. Then, like the flash of Langhorne's own rockery, understanding struck, and he swore vilely. Damn it! Damn it! He'd known there were three of them all along, and he'd let himself forget. Let himself get so focused, so concentrated on the ship alongside, that he'd completely ignored the threat of its third consort. Even through the blinding banks of gunsmoke, he could see Prince of Dolar's masts swinging around as she fell downwind. Despite the fact that her rigging appeared intact, it was obvious she was no longer under control, which meant either her wheel or her rudder must have carried away. In either case, she was no longer able to maneuver, and Saigon swore again as the third Carizian, main topsail briefly backed to slow her as she charged along under an insane press of canvas, poured a second raking broadside into Prince of Dolar's bows. Even as he watched, the Carizian galleon was slicing up to lay herself between guardsmen and her current opponent, and Saigon felt his belly knot at the thought of suddenly finding himself engaged at 2-to-1 odds. Especially 2-to-1 odds, half of which was the completely untouched galleon, which had just effectively knocked Prince of Dolar out of action with just two broadsides.
"Starboard your helm!"
he commanded, and guardsmen fell quickly off to larboard. She swung downwind, momentarily offering her stern to Squall as she broke away to leeward. It was Arnald Stewart's turn to swear. Squall was still moving faster than either Dart or Guardsman, as he used her momentum to drive between the other two galleons. Even his well-drilled crew was frantically busy, as gunners thundered across the deck from right to left, and Guardsman's abrupt turn exposed her stern. It would have been the perfect lethal opening to rake his second opponent, if Squall's own heading hadn't robbed him of the opportunity. His larboard battery was loaded and ready, his starboard gun crews had gotten there in time to man the guns, but the two ships' relative motion carried guardsmen outside the arc of Squall's fire until she'd swung far enough to come almost parallel to her. Instead of the rake he'd almost achieved, the two ships passed in opposite directions, larboard to larboard on what amounted to reverse headings, with guardsmen to leeward of Squall. Stuart's gunners were as disappointed as their captain by the lost opportunity, but they recovered quickly and poured a destructive broadside into their foe as they passed. Guardsman was unable to reply. She'd been engaged against Dart with her starboard battery. Her larboard guns had never been loaded or run out, and her crew were still frantically casting off lashings when Squall fired. The range was much longer than the range to Prince of Dolar had been, and double-shotted guns were notoriously inaccurate at anything above half-pistol shot. On the other hand, Squall's gunners were very good, and guardsmen staggered amid a chorus of screams as a fresh hurricane of iron blasted into her. Mardai Saigon was no coward, or he would never have been handpicked by the Earl of Thirsk as one of his first galleon commanders. Yet he was no more immune to the effects of surprise than the next man, and he felt something entirely too much like panic as the Carisian broadside crashed into his ship.
"Stop it," he commanded himself fiercely. "Yes, you let the bastard sneak up on you. Accept that and deal with it."
He shook his head like a man shaking off a punch to the jaw, then drew a deep breath and looked around, assessing the situation.
"How did it go to shit so quickly?"
he wondered a moment later. Prince of Dolar was drifting on the wind, completely out of control. She'd cleared the worst of the smoke, as had guardsmen on her present course, and Saigon could see her clearly now. Not that it was much comfort. Judging from the chaos on her decks and the bodies hanging in her tops and draped over her hammock nettings, she must have been hit extraordinarily hard by the Carisian's two broadsides. Worse, there was no evidence of any organized response to her difficulties, and Captain Germain was too good, too competent, for things to be drifting that way if he were still on his feet. That was bad enough, but Grand Vicar Maris was even farther downwind than Prince of Dolar or Guardsman herself. Unlike Germain's ship, Rosale clearly had Grand Vicar Maris under command, but her rigging had been severely damaged. It looked as if even Rosale had had enough, and as Saigon saw the streams of red oozing down her sides, human blood literally running from her scuppers, he didn't blame the other captain one bit. And, just to make Saigon's day complete, Rockerai was making clumsily off to leeward, as best she could without foremast or headsails as well. Which meant that, in effect, his own guardsmen and Kral's Bedard were the only effective Dolaran galleons left. He looked back astern, where Squall had altered course yet again, coming up alongside Dart. Even as Saigon watched, the Carisian flagship's four topgallant and four royal seemed to bend forward slowly, buckling into the smoke in a welter of snapping shrouds and stays. No one had been firing at her at the moment, so it had to be the result of cumulative damage, but Saigon wasn't about to complain. More guns thundered from the southwest, and he turned his attention that way to see Bedard breaking off as well. Andair Kral was maintaining a brisk fire on his larger opponent, but his true purpose was clearly to cover his own wounded flagship until she could get clear.
"And what the hell do we do?" Mardai Saigon asked himself harshly.
Harris I. Wayne watched Bedard veering away. Instinct urged him to follow up, crowding the smaller ship and pounding her into submission, or at least driving her off while he finished his business with the Dolaran flagship. Unfortunately, he still didn't know what was happening astern of him. What he could see was that Dart's four topgallant and four royal had gone by the board, leaving the flagship all but dismasted. Combined with the heavy casualties he already knew Powell's company had suffered, Dart would be all but helpless if anyone managed to get to grips with her. And while it was obvious Stuart had finally been able to bring Squall into action, apparently with crushing effectiveness, Iwane had no idea how badly damaged Guardsman or Prince of Dolar might actually be. He looked further down to leeward and saw several columns of smoke rising from the sea. It looked as if Flash and Mace had managed to get to grips with the convoy after all. He doubted they'd managed to pick off more than a few of the coasters before the others scattered, but some was better than none.
"Yes, it is," he thought, "and yes, you'd really like to finish at least one of the bastards off. But Dart's been shot to shit. You've got more than enough dead and wounded of your own,
We're the better part of 1,000 miles even from Trove Island, and there's no telling when another squadron of these bloody-minded bastards is going to turn up.
He grimaced unhappily at his unpalatable conclusion. Unfortunately, he couldn't dispute his own logic.
Stuart watched guardsmen making more sail. She was clearly running, and under the circumstances, much as he might have liked to, Stuart couldn't really fault her skipper's thinking. At the very least, he needed to get clear while he figured out what was going on.
"And when he does, they're going to go on running," Stuart decided.
Two of their ships had suffered heavy damage aloft, whereas Squall's and Shield's rigging was still effectively intact. They'd want to protect their cripples, and Stuart had no idea how close Dolaran reinforcements might be. It was possible this wasn't the only squadron Thirsk had sent to sea, in which case their fleeing opponents might just happen to lead them straight into an ambush. Under the circumstances, he was willing to let them run if they were willing to do the running. Besides, he had Dart to worry about, and then there was Prince of Dolar. She still hadn't been brought back under control, which suggested Squall's fire had been even more effective than Stuart had been prepared to assume. That didn't mean she wasn't going to recover at any moment, though, and if she did, she could well pose a serious threat to the crippled Carizian flagship.
"Best to make sure of her," he decided. "She's our wyvern, after all."
He grinned at the thought, then gave himself a shake.
"Very well, Master Maldon," he said. "Prepare to put the ship about, if you please."
He twitched his head in Prince of Dolar's direction.
"I believe we have a prize to collect."
3. HMS Empress of Karas, Telesburg, Kingdom of Old Karas. HMS Empress of Karas was no longer the most powerfully armed warship in the world. In fact, 18 of her 68 gun ports were empty, leaving her with only 28 long 30-pounders on the gun deck and 4 long 14s and 18 30-pounder carronades on her spar deck. Despite the reduced armament, she remained one of the most powerfully armed warships in the world, however, and she also remained Emperor Caleb's favorite flagship, which was why she was currently ghosting towards the oared galleys off the Telesburg seawall. There was very little wind, barely enough to raise a light swell, and with every stitch of canvas set, she was making no more than 2 knots. In fact, probably less. The fitful breeze barely sufficed to occasionally flap the banner at her mizzen peak, but that was enough to display, fitfully perhaps, the golden Armach Kraken swimming across the silver and blue checkerboard of Chisholm, quartered with the black of Karas. But this banner was different from any other Imperial Carizian banner, for it displayed both a gold and a silver crown above the Kraken, indicating that both of the Empire of Karas's monarchs were aboard. Which in turn had something to do with the hordes of light craft swarming out to meet her, and the deafening cheers rising from them. Almost a full year had passed since Empress Charlian's departure for Chisholm, and it had been a year and a half since Emperor Caleb had sailed for Coruscant. In fact, they'd been officially supposed to return to Telesburg a full month earlier, and more than one old Carizian had waxed grumpily, eloquently so in some cases, over the delay. Of course, half the delay was due solely to contrary winds on the voyage home, which not even an emperor or an empress could expect to do anything about. Still, they had been supposed to leave Chiraeth a full 3-5 days earlier than they had, and there was no denying that a certain rivalry had already arisen between the Carizian Empire's twin capitals. Overall, it was a remarkably friendly rival, but that made it no less real, and the more persnickety old Carizians had taken exception to their monarch's decision to extend their stay in Chiraeth. For the most part, those who complained found scant sympathy from their fellows.
For one thing, their youthful monarchs were remarkably popular with their subjects, aside, of course, from the temple loyalists, most of whom would have liked nothing better than to see them dead, but one couldn't have everything. For a second thing, most of their subjects understood that the rulers of an empire, fighting for its life against the other 70 or 80% of the world, might, upon occasion, find themselves involuntarily forced to alter schedules. And for a third thing, as a direct consequence of that need to occasionally alter schedules, Charlian had spent 3 extra months in Telesburg before she ever left for Chiraeth. Yet the true reason the complainers were rather brusquely told to shut their mouths was the news that not only was Empress Charlian pregnant, but that the heir to the imperial throne would be born right here in Telesburg. The child would be not just a Carizian, but an old Carizian by birth. Doubtless the royal family would be far too tactful ever to say so, but everyone who mattered would know. Hence the wild tide of cheering sweeping over those hundreds of small craft as Empress of Caris furled her canvas and the towing hawsers went across to the galleys waiting to shepherd her to Quayside. Take that, Chiraeth.
You know, if all our old Carizians don't stop gloating, we're likely to have a civil war, Regis Yawance said whimsically.
The Earl of Grey Harbor sat at the foot of the dining table, looking up its length at Caleb. Charlian sat to Caleb's right, facing Bishop Heinrich Wagner across the table, and Benjamin Race sat to the bishop's right. Rajir Machlin, to the Empress's left, completed the dinner party, which seemed, especially to Wave Thunder and Grey Harbor, inescapably incomplete without Merlin Athrawis standing at the Emperor's back.
"Oh, surely not, Regis," Wagner responded to Grey Harbor's statement serenely.
He was approaching 80 years of age, with snow-white hair and brown eyes surrounded by smile wrinkles. His slender frame, stooped posture, and the prominent veins on the backs of his hands gave an impression of frailty, but his health was actually excellent, and there was nothing at all wrong with his mind.
"Oh, no, my lord," Grey Harbor smiled. "Perhaps you haven't been listening to what I've been hearing."
"I've heard as much gloating, excuse me, excessively joyous celebratory comment as you have," Wagner replied. "I'm certain, however, that Her Grace's Chisobians will never take undue offense. After all,"
it was his turn to smile,
"the heir may be born here in Telesburg, but where was the child conceived?"
Grey Harbor's eyes widened, and he sat back in his chair, gazing at the bishop for a long moment. Then he shook his head.
"Do you know, that never even occurred to me?"
He shook his head again, his expression bemused.
"My, my, they are going to gloat over that, aren't they?"
"As a matter of fact, they already have," Caleb said in a resigned tone. "Gloating, I mean. And talking about mysterious things in Chisomian water or air."
He smiled crookedly.
"I know everyone in the Empire has a legitimate interest in securing the succession. I understand that. I even sympathize with it. But I have to tell you, I'm beginning to feel like some prized racehorse or dragon stud."
"Which makes me precisely what, if I may inquire?" Charlian asked, resting one hand on her swollen abdomen.
"The other half of the equation?" Caleb suggested innocently, and she whacked him across the knuckles with her other hand.
"You see what I have to put up with?" she asked the table in general, and a chorus of laughs answered.
"Actually, Your Grace," Grey Harbor said then, his expression more serious, "having your child conceived in Chisholm and born in Old Caris is probably the very best thing that could have happened. With all due respect for His Majesty's delicate feelings, and your own, of course, this has to be the most widely discussed pregnancy in the history of both kingdoms. And," his smile turned suddenly gentle, "the vast majority of your subjects are delighted for you."
"That, Your Grace, is absolutely true," Wagner said softly. We've offered Thanksgiving masses every Wednesday afternoon in Telesburg Cathedral since we received news of your pregnancy. Attendance has been high, and a lot of your subjects have been quietly leaving small offertory gifts, a few coins here or there, sometimes just a spray of flowers, or a little note telling you how hard they're praying for you and your child.
He shook his head.
I very much doubt that any prospective mother in Carisian history has ever been the recipient of as many prayers and blessings as you have.
Charlian colored slightly, but she met his gaze steadily across the table, then gave a small nod of acceptance.
Actually,
Wave Thunder's brisk tone was that of a man deliberately changing the mood.
The one thing that seems just plain wrong to me is having both Michael and Merlin someplace else.
Heads nodded soberly as someone finally said it out loud. Grey Harbor, the only person present who didn't know the true story of the young woman named Nemu Albin, still knew about Sajan Merlin's visions. He also knew how close to both Caleb and Charlian Merlin had become. So he wasn't surprised to hear Wave Thunder include the Sajan right along with the Archbishop.
I agree, Charlian said after a moment, her voice soft.
But then she shrugged.
I agree, but we all knew Michael probably couldn't get back from Coruscant in time, and there was no way we were letting him go there without Merlin. Not after what happened to Father Timon.
I don't see how anyone could fault your priorities, Your Grace,
Wagner's voice had turned grim.
The murder of any child of God is a thing of grief and horror. To murder anyone, especially a priest, in so hideous a fashion, simply to terrify others into obedience, goes beyond grief and horror to abomination.
There were no smiles now, for no one could miss the bishop's implication. Reports had amply confirmed what had happened to Jaspar Clinton's enemies in the Temple and Zion, and, as Wagner had just said, it went beyond grief and horror to atrocity. 31 vicars had been arrested, put to the question, and suffered the punishment of Schuller. Including Samuel and Howard Wilson, 33 of the 300 vicars of the Church of God Awaiting had died. 8 of the Wilsons' fellow reformists had been fortunate enough to die under the question. 23 had been delivered to the full, hideous catalog of barbarisms the punishment demanded before their final death by fire. Only 16 had actually lived long enough to be burned, which seemed a scant enough mercy. 52 bishops and archbishops had joined them, as had the personal staffs of almost every one of the condemned prelates. Wives had been put to the question as well, and every one of them had been executed, although Clinton had extended the mercy of merely having them hanged. Children over the age of 12 had been rigorously interrogated. Most over the age of 15 had joined their parents. The questionings and the punishments had taken over 2 months to complete, and the city of Zion was in shock. All told, almost 2,500 had been arrested, and over 1,400 men, women, and children had died. Surviving infants and babes in arms had been graciously spared by Mother Church and consigned to other members of the vicarate to be reared. Children over the age of 4, those whose lives had been spared, had been remanded to monastic communities, most in Harchong, the citadel of orthodoxy, with traditions of severe asceticism and discipline. Nor had Clinton missed the opportunity to trot out the handful of Carisian survivors of the Farade massacre. There weren't many of them, only 7, in fact, and every one of them had been a tottering physical wreck, eager to confess to anything, even knowing they were to be burned, if only that would end the horror their lives had become. And so they had confessed to every conceivable heresy and perversion, proclaimed their worship of Shan Wei, their hatred of God, the pacts in which they had knowingly sold their souls to the dark. Against the backdrop of that evidence of how deeply the Carisian apostasy had penetrated, that self-confessed proof of the Church of Carus's heretical abominations, and the way in which it had sold itself to evil, the Grand Vicar's long-anticipated declaration of holy war had been almost an afterthought. No one had questioned it, just as there was no voice raised against Clinton and the group of four in the temple lands. Not any longer. There was no one left who would have dared to raise one. Yet, if there were no raised voices, there were rumors, whispers, that the Grand Inquisitor's sweep had been less complete than he'd intended. Several of the condemned vicar's families had mysteriously vanished, and dozens of bishops' and archbishops' families had done the same. No one knew how many had escaped the Inquisition's net, yet the fact that any had managed it chipped away, if only slightly, at the omnipotent aura of Clinton's iron fist. There were counter-rumors, of course, whispers that the missing family's miraculous escape was proof of Shan Wei's influence, proof they'd been her minions in very truth. That only the Mother of Darkness could possibly have whisked them out of the Inquisition's grasp. There was no doubt in the minds of the people around Caleb and Charlian's supper table who was responsible for those whispers. Nor did anyone doubt that one reason they'd been crafted was to discredit any testimony those escapees might offer if ever they reached safety in the Carisian Empire.
"Forgive me," Wagner said softly after a moment. "This dinner is supposed to be a celebration. I apologize for darkening it."
"My lord, you're not the one who darkened it," Charlian told him. "We all know who did that, and I fear thoughts of what's happened in Zion are never far from any of us."
"Nor should they be," Caleb said harshly.
They looked at him, and he shook his head fiercely.
"Those bastards have a great deal to answer for. And we owe it to all their victims to remember that it's not just what they've done or tried to do to us. It's what they've done to anyone who dares to get in their way." "Yes, Your Majesty, it is." Wagner shook his head sadly. "All our priests are reporting they've been approached by parishioners trying desperately to understand how even the group of four could commit such acts in God's name. We tried to comfort them, but the truth is that none of us really understand it ourselves."
He shook his head again.
"Oh, intellectually, yes, but inside, emotionally, where our own faith in the goodness and love of God resides, no."
"That's because you do believe in God's love and goodness, Heinrich," Greyharbor said. "I don't know what, if anything, Trinair and Maguire truly believe in, but I think we've all seen what Clinton believes. At best, he believes solely in his own power. At worst, he truly believes in some monstrous perversion of God. And in either case, he's willing to do anything at all to accomplish his ends."
"I'm afraid you're right," Wagner sighed. "But that doesn't give much scope for comforting those who are frightened and confused. All we can do is urge them to pray, trust God, and remember the duty of all good and godly people to resist evil wherever it may be found, even in the orange of a vicar's cassock. I'm afraid that can be scant comfort, no matter how strong someone's faith is. And especially for those who remain ignorant of loved ones' fates, like Father Pater."
He looked across the table at Charlian, his eyes dark, and she nodded slightly in understanding. She knew how dreadfully tempted Wagner must have been to reassure Pater Wilson that his stepmother and his brothers and sister had escaped. She was more than a little awed by the way the young intendant had managed to continue discharging his responsibilities in the wake of his father's and his uncle's confirmed deaths, and the total silence where the rest of his family was concerned. She also knew how much Wagner, like everyone else who had ever worked with the young Schulerite, respected and admired and even loved him. Watching him deal with his grief and fear would have been hard enough under any circumstances. Watching him go through all of that when Wagner could have told him the rest of his family would be joining him in Tellisburg only made it even worse.
"But they're going to be here within another 2 or 3 5 days," she reminded herself. "Their ship's already halfway across the anvil. He'll know then, God bless him, and them."
"I understand exactly what you're saying, Heinrich," she said out loud, meeting those dark eyes head on. "And I agree. I wish there were a way to comfort all of those fears and concerns."
"If you'll forgive me, Your Grace," Grey Harbor said quietly, "I think you're about to do just that for a great many of your subjects."
She cocked an eyebrow at him, and he glanced at Wagner. "You apologized for bringing the subject up, Heinrich. But the truth is, reminding us of what's transpired in Zion may not be that bad a thing, especially at a moment like this. I think it helps us here in Old Karras, and throughout the Empire, to realize how blessed we truly are. We at least know precisely what we're fighting for, that God has given us the opportunity to put an end to the butchery of someone like Clinton. How often are men and women given the chance to accomplish something that important? I think all our people, even those frightened and confused souls seeking comfort you just mentioned, realize that deep down inside. And that, Your Grace," he returned his gaze to Charlian, "is why your child is so important to all of them. Because they genuinely love you and Caleb, yes, I believe that too. But this child represents more than just the securing of an imperial succession. He, or she, is also the symbol of the struggle that empire was forged to fight."